All right, so picking back up in Numbers, kind of again, our introductory kind of things here, title of the book. Once again, get our title from the Latin Vulgate, numeri or numeri, and that's derived from the Septuagint, arithmoi, so we get like arithmetic, all that. And so this name is like kind of likely connected with the two censuses that occur in the book. And yes, the term is censuses. I had to look that up because it's like, what's the plural of census? It doesn't sound right to say censuses, but it is apparently, at least according to Google, unless I got something wrong. But that's what it is. So probably connecting to those two censuses that are in the book. So we get this book, Numbers. The Hebrew title, Bemidbar, okay. It comes from kind of some of the first words, not the exact first words this time, kind of the first time it does into that, but in the first phrase. And that term, that phrase is in the wilderness. Okay, that's what that means, is in the wilderness. So if you're looking there, verse 1, the Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness. And so, again, kind of fitting words since the events of the book take place in a wilderness, okay, in the wilderness, as the nation begins to move from kind of Mount Sinai to the promised land. So if you remember, that's where they've been for a while. Exodus, they left Egypt, got to Mount Sinai. That's where they've kind of been for the rest of Exodus, Leviticus, all that is Mount Sinai. The beginning of Numbers will be at Mount Sinai, but then in Numbers, they start the move to the promised land. All right, theme of the book, kind of a couple. There's a lot of fitting themes, so kind of the ones I gravitate towards are, one, you could say like the God who displays his holiness. The God who displays his holiness. So again, we just saw in Leviticus, like, he is the holy God. And so we're going to see that on display in the book of Numbers. And then the second theme that you could also say is the God who refines his people. The God who refines his people. And so, again, these are kind of connected to. These aren't totally distinct. Whereas God displays his holiness, and that process, he will also be refining his people to be the holy people that he wants them to be. Okay? And then the structure of the book, there's a couple of suggestions for how to kind of outline this book, and you have a couple, you have two different ones there on your sheet. One relates to, again, kind of geography, as we've seen a couple times with some of the other books. So, like, you have, like, Israel and Mount Sinai for the first 10 chapters or so, then Israel in the wilderness, and then Israel at the plains of Moab, kind of right before entering the land, all that stuff. And then the other outline is kind of centered around those two censuses. So the first sentence, census, dealing with kind of the older generation, chapters 1 through 25. And then the second census, which kind of focuses on the new generation, and chapters 26 to 36. And we're going to kind of go with that second one there that focuses on the censuses, just so I can keep saying that word and censuses and all that. Still sounds weird every time I say it. All right, so that's kind of the structure we're going to go with, all right? So getting into Numbers itself, the first census kind of here, the old generation in chapters 1 through 25, we have that census take place. So again, riveting stuff. You start with a bunch of census here of all the different tribes of Israel. And so this is a census of all the older generation. So that includes every man 20 years or older in Israel at that time. And if you're kind of looking through these lists, who's the largest tribe at this point? If you look through all these different numbers. I wouldn't expect you just to know that off the top of your head. But glance through some of these numbers. Judah, all right, Judah is the largest tribe, and that's, and it's by pretty significant margin that they're kind of the biggest tribe, and why would that be significant? What's significant about Judah? Huh? Okay, yeah, eventually, yeah, that's where Christ comes from, and kind of linked with that, what do we see in Genesis? Who, what would also come through the line of Judah? Not just the Messiah, but what else? Regarding Israel. David does. What do they both have kind of in common?
Abraham.
Kings, yeah, kings. This is the line of the kings, right? So they are kind of the tribe that the leadership is going to come from. And so it's kind of fitting that they are kind of the largest tribe as kind of the leader in a sense. Okay. All right. And then what you'll notice, right, as you compare kind of this first census to the second one later on in chapter 26, you'll have certain tribes like the tribe of Simeon. They will decrease pretty drastically. And then others like the tribe of Manasseh will grow pretty significantly as well. And we'll talk about that when we get to that. But even with that, you still have Judah kind of even grows a little bit more, and they kind of remain that largest tribe. Okay, so again, making sense because they are that kind of kingly line. Okay, the line of the leadership. They will lead Israel. All right, and so then tied in with that a little bit, you get into chapter 2, kind of the arrangement of the camp. So how Israel as a nation is arranged as they're kind of camped out here at Sinai and then in the wilderness and everything. But what's significant is the tribe that is kind of first on the east side, which is the direction they're going to be heading as they're heading to the promised land, is the nation of Judah. And so again, they're going to be like the first one setting out. So again, they are like the leaders. They are leading as that tribe. But the other significant thing of kind of you have all these tribes arranged in a certain way. Do you notice what's at like the center of their camp? I just took a guess maybe. Tabernacle. Yeah, the tabernacle is at the center of their camp. So all the tribes are kind of around it with the tabernacle in the middle. And the question is, well, why? Well, because like in the ancient Near East at that time, you would always put kind of like your king or your most important person in the middle to protect them. Okay, so if someone attacked, they are kind of in the middle. They are protected and everything. And we do the same thing today with like bodyguards, right? That like whoever they're protecting is kind of the middle. Wouldn't be good of like, yeah, I'll guard you. Go walk up in front of me. That's fine, right? That's not a good bodyguard. So it's kind of this protection here. But this isn't so much protecting, right, that God needs like Israel to protect him, right? But rather it's more the emphasis on showing who is like the most important, which is God. Okay, and so if you were to look at their camp, if you're kind of these outside nations sending your spies to kind of look at their camp, you would immediately notice that like in the middle of this, you have this structure. Okay, you have this structure kind of in the middle of that. And that therefore must be very important to these people, okay, is the structure. And so really by placing the tabernacle there, Israel is proclaiming to the world who their true king is, who the most important person is, right? It's God. That's what even the arrangement of their camp kind of shows. All right. Next couple of chapters, we see kind of the duties of the Levites. And you have to remember kind of that while all priests are Levites, not all Levites are priests. Okay, kind of like, yeah, I don't know how to say that. So all priests are Levites, but not all Levites are priests. And so it's those in the line of Aaron, those are the priests. And so then you now have these three other families that were not priests, but they had certain duties as Levites. And so you have these three families. There's Kohath, Gershon, and Merari, something like that. And so you have the different responsibilities given. So Kohath, their descendants, like they were responsible for kind of the innards of the tabernacle. So such as like the Ark of the Covenant, the lamp, like all those different things. They were in charge of like kind of moving those things whenever they got up as a camp and left. You then have Gershon, they're responsible for the fabric of the tabernacle, so like the covering, the screens, all those materials, they would take care of that. And then Merari, they were responsible for kind of like the frame, the pillars, the bases, all that stuff. And so each family had a specific thing they were responsible for as they packed up and moved the tabernacle. And kind of the purpose of this would essentially be that this is like an organized process. It's an organized process. And so, because if you think of it, right, like what would this communicate to the nations If when they moved and stuff, if they just kind of tore down the tabernacle, like, oh, let's just throw this thing over here and throw that, right? And like kind of how we might pack some stuff, just kind of toss it around. It's normally not something you value, okay, right? If you don't really care how something's broken down and you just kind of like, oh, I'll toss it over here. I don't know, does someone have that? Did someone grab that? I don't know. If we're missing a pillar, right? Like all these things, right? Like that would communicate that what? Like this isn't very important. But if this is all done in kind of this meticulous, organized way, it's showing again the importance of this structure and what it is representing. Okay, that they value this dwelling place of their God. Okay, and so it shows that it is important, as well as that once again, like God is a God of order, not chaos, which we saw even all the way back in creation and everything. Okay, so we see that, and then in chapter 5, kind of described as holiness in the camp. And so these chapters kind of focus on keeping the camp of the Israelites holy, just as we saw kind of demanded in the book of Leviticus. And so this chapter starts out here by kind of making sure all those who are unclean would be put kind of outside the camp. So again, that kind of unclean thing. And again, this would put something on display where if you were a spy kind of watching Israel, there would be kind of this stream of people leaving the camp, entering the camp, leaving the camp. Like, what's going on? What is with these people, right? Like, and so again, opportunity to display God's holiness, that there is nothing unclean can dwell with him, right? Like there's that reality there being on display. Okay. And then, like, in chapter 5, you also kind of, like, I don't know, maybe you've encountered this, kind of like a weird passage that's, like, a test for, like, adultery. Not to do today, but, like, that they would do, right? Where this is one where it's, like, if someone was suspected of committing adultery and there's no witnesses of it, then they would kind of go to a priest, and they would get some water, put some dust in it, declare an oath over the person, and when they drank the water, if they were guilty, like the lady would be like barren if she was guilty, so couldn't have kids anymore. But if she was innocent, then she would be able to conceive and have children. And people offer up so many explanations of what's going on, of like, was this like magic or psychological or whatever? But no, it's just, this is how God would have punished someone in Israel, like during that time, right? Like, and so, it was something that he would cause them to be barren or whatever in that. So again, that's just something back then. That's not like what we do. We don't go grab our dust and water. But all that. But again, the emphasis here is on the holiness of God. That's the emphasis. That's what's going on. Chapter 6, that's where we get the instructions or guidelines for what we call like the Nazirite vow. So for those who would be a Nazirite, and maybe you've heard of this because we have a couple important individuals in scripture who were Nazirites that took these vows. Like, for example, like Samson, famous one. We'll get to him at some point, which some people say he's like the anti-Nazirite because he just kind of did everything he wasn't supposed to do and all that. So not a great example of that. But you had Samson, you had Samuel, and even like John the Baptist was one. Okay. And so really the purpose of the Nazirite was to be totally dedicated to the Lord. That was really their purpose, is they were to be dedicated to the Lord. And this would be visibly seen in that, like, they wouldn't cut their hair. They wouldn't drink from the vine. They wouldn't go near a dead body of anything, right? Like, they would stand out. They would be different. And the Nazirites then would serve as this reminder to Israel and the world that God's holiness requires absolute dedication. Okay, so they would be kind of this visible, and it requires this visible dedication that actually kind of changes your life and is obvious to others. That's really the purpose of the Nazirites, to be this demonstration. Okay? And then also in chapter 6, you have what we call the Aaronic blessing. So the blessing of Aaron that the priests would say to the people. They would bless them in this way. And the significance of this is that essentially this shows that holiness will lead to blessing. And this is also like part of that blessing is like, may like the Lord shine his face upon you, if you've heard that kind of idea. And so that's important language for us to like be aware of as you read through the rest of the Old Testament, that the Lord shining his face on people, that's like a language of blessing. But then kind of the flip side, if God is kind of hiding his face from his people, then what? That's language of cursing, okay? And you see that in some of the later prophets during later times where it talks about like God hiding his face from Israel and different things. Like it's that's language of cursing. All right. And then chapter 7, you have kind of this the dedication of offering for the altar. And this kind of takes us back a little bit. So to like the end of Exodus, like when we saw the end of Exodus, when things were being set up and consecrated, this just goes into more detail of that offering that was used to dedicate things for like the altar. And all that, you have kind of all the leadership of the different tribes giving offerings for this dedication. And so like some oxen were given, wagons were given and things. Those would be used kind of in some of the transporting of the tabernacle and all that. So you have all that kind of taking place here. Then you also have like the lamps in the tabernacle. So you have some specific instructions regarding the lamps. And then you have the cleansing of the Levites. So just like we saw in Leviticus, where the priests needed to be consecrated, cleansed, so that they could serve the Lord in those capacities, the rest of the Levites then need to be cleansed as well to be able to serve in their capacity of kind of transporting all the different things and handling all that. They needed to be cleansed as well. Okay? All right. And then they celebrate the Passover. So chapter 9, we see this, they are celebrating the Passover in the first month of the second year that they had come out from the land of Egypt. And so it's been a little time, all right, since they've left Egypt. They're still in the wilderness, all that, still at Sinai at this point, but they are putting to practice even the Passover as we've seen. And then we have kind of the preparations for departing. So again, as I mentioned, part of Numbers is we're transitioning away from Mount Sinai, getting back to the land, the promised land. And we have here in chapter 9, they're making some preparations for departing. And so first of all, God gives these kind of instructions of like when you see the cloud over the tabernacle, when it remains over the tabernacle, that means like we're staying here, we're staying put, all that. But when the cloud is lifted up from over the tent, then what? That's a signal they're supposed to depart. They're supposed to leave. And second, they also, like, he has them, like, make some trumpets to also signal when they're supposed to depart and when to stay, all that stuff. Because remember, they are large people now, so you need trumpets to make sure everyone knows what's going on. And again, the point is the nation would be organized. They would be organized in their settling, in their departing. It would all be in order because, again, their God is a God of order, not of chaos. And so that is what is being on, put on display even in this as they prepare to depart. And then the last thing we'll touch on for tonight is they actually do depart. Chapter 10, they depart for the land. And so with all the preparations in place, they now start heading to Mount Sinai. And if you notice in verse 14 of chapter 10 here, we see kind of the first to set out by their companies is who? Judah. Okay, they, again, they're the leader. They're leading the way. Okay, they are the kingly line, and they are kind of functioning as it are ready. Okay? So it actually takes us where we need to go. And we actually ended a few minutes early. Look at that. We did it. All right. So...